Ron Rosenbaum, mornings 8 to 11 on AM 1500 KSTP.
If you listen closely, you may notice that Mishki takes great license with some of the details surrounding the news of the day. Listen at your own amusement. Thank you.
And now, a presentation of the Black Sheep Broadcasting Network. Gentlemen, Black Sheep Radio now presents the Mishki Broadcast, featuring the broadcast outcast, transmitting live from his renegade radio outpost, here in the final 90 feet of the city of St. Paul.
Top of the evening to you folks. Michael Hirsch is my guest this hour. He is the former foreign editor and chief diplomatic correspondent for Newsweek, currently a senior editor in the magazine's Washington Bureau. He has written a book called At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. He has written for Foreign Affairs, Harper's, Washington Monthly. He was co-winner of the Overseas Press Club Award for Best Magazine Reporting from Abroad in 2001, for prescience in identifying the Al-Qaeda threat half a year before September 11th, and for Newsweek's coverage of the War on Terror, which also won a National Magazine Award. I want to welcome him to the show now. Hello, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining me. I think this is the topic of our time in so many ways, and I found myself wondering as I read your book how many Americans are taking the time when you think about how busy people are and how they have to think about neighborhood politics, city politics, state politics, national politics. How many are taking the time to really look at America's role on the planet? And yet, what becomes quite clear from reading your book is that that may be ultimately what affects them the greatest in the coming years, is how this country deals with its role on this planet. And it's a daunting task to ask the average person to delve into this, because it's a complex picture. You yourself have spent a lot of time with it, and this is an attempt, I take it, on your part to try and give people a better picture of where America is, where it should be, where it could be, in terms of its relationship with the other nations of this world and its role as a leader.
Well, that's right. I think, you know, one of the messages of the book is this is not rocket science. You know, this is not like trying to understand the intricacies of nuclear physics. This is about a common sense understanding of what America needs to do as the only superpower in the world. And issues like, you know, going to war with Iraq can be debated, the timing and the necessity of it. But I think what can't be debated is the need for the United States to play a very subtle but forceful role as a dominant power, but working with other powers. And I think that, you know, what I've detected anyway is a lot of people who have a deep-seated anger with the Bush administration for the way that it's handled, or mishandled, I should say, diplomacy. And I don't think it's, again, something that is so arcane that people can't get more engaged in these issues.
You give the Bush administration a fair amount of credit in your book for being more forceful than the Clinton administration. A lot of this book is comparing the two administrations.
Mm-hmm.
You do see President Bush as offering the country something that President Clinton failed to give us.
No, that's right. I think that if there was any major criticism that I would leave people of Clinton's foreign policy, it was that he did create a sense of vulnerability project to some degree an image of weakness. This was the critique that the Bush team made of him coming in. If you look at bin Laden's rhetoric going back to the late 90s, coming out of his hideouts in Afghanistan, the kinds of things he was saying on his videotapes, there was the perception that America was, as he said, a paper tiger. So I do think that Clinton was a military minimalist, but I also think that Bush perhaps has gone too far in the other direction.
You titled the book At War With Ourselves. Why that title?
Well, because I think the fundamental obstacle here, I mean, to get back to the idea that Americans need to get more engaged in these issues, the fundamental obstacle that we have to overcome is one in our own minds. We have, and have had since the beginning of the Republic, a sense of ourselves as a nation apart. We don't want to be too engaged in the global system. We'll get pulled in occasionally in big wars, but we would like to retreat home again. And I think what we haven't reckoned with is the idea that the international system, the globalized economy, the international system of treaties and institutions that we now know is our system. We invented it, basically. And it's consummately in our interests to bolster and perpetuate this system. And that even means, you know, supporting institutions like the UN, for example.
And, then,
and I think we need as a nation, as a people, we need to embrace that idea.
And you argue quite well in the book that these are things we created. It doesn't make sense for us to run from them now. But that was a big sticking point in this last war, and I think there was a threshold that was crossed in this country with a lot of people over just what purpose the UN is going to serve when it comes to situations where a strong statement needs to be made, some chances need to be taken, and you have to risk upsetting some other countries.
Yeah.
In those situations, is the UN the institution to count on?
Not necessarily. There are certain situations where the UN will not act. It didn't act, for example, in authorizing a war in Kosovo, although we later used the UN to orchestrate peacekeeping mission, and an end to that war. But there are occasions when you can bypass the UN. I mean, certainly we are not beholden to the UN as some sort of sovereign power over us, nor will we ever be. The UN is, in fact, something we made and rarely acts beyond what we want it to do. But I think at the same time, it is really a misunderstanding to think that the UN is therefore useless, that it's become, as the Bush team liked to say during the Iraq debate, you know, the League of Nations, or what if it didn't act. I think if you look at what the UN does, its agencies, for example, in Afghanistan, to a large extent the nation-building infrastructure going on there is being done by the UN and UN agencies. I think if you look at Iraq, most dramatically now, I mean, how much longer do we really want, as Americans, 3 or 4 or 5 soldiers dying a week? I think we want to bring in institutions like the UN and NATO into that. So I think what we have to do is step back and you know, focus on what works with the UN, discard the rest, but at least accept the idea that it's not, you know, it is not entirely a useless entity.
When I look at the cover of your book and I read Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World, I think of the people listening right now, and there are a fair number who would say to themselves, let's see, we went into Afghanistan and took a not-so-good situation and made it better. We went into Iraq, took a not-so-good situation and made it better. Isn't America building a better world right now?
Well, you could argue that. I think we could be doing a much better job. I think one of the things that we need, that this administration needs to address, is that, you know, if you're going to go in and you're going to transform the Arab world in the way that they've talked about with Iraq as the starting point, then, you know, then do it. Then face up to what you as an administration were rejecting at the very beginning, which was the idea of nation building and large-scale peacekeeping. And you know, and do that with both feet. I mean, I think the issue right now is whether or not this administration will, you know, will really do what it needs to do, which is over the next several months really pour some more resources in there and wrestle that situation under control. So you know, you can argue about how much the Bush administration is doing. It certainly is not doing nothing. I think it could be doing more.
Are you comfortable with what's going on in Afghanistan? Do you think Americans know all that's going on in Afghanistan in terms of our commitment there?
No, I'm not comfortable. I think this is a case where it was clear that a larger peacekeeping force than the one just situated in Kabul was needed. That Hamid Karzai, who is the president of Afghanistan, the guy we support, is effectively the mayor of Kabul. He doesn't really have much power beyond that. And that we could be doing more there. Because I think we have to reckon with the idea that failing states or failed states like Afghanistan can do enormous damage in a way we had never anticipated. I mean, that was really the lesson of 9/11.
When I look at Afghanistan, what I find myself thinking about my country is I'm not sure how interested my country is in acting altruistically versus simply acting solely in its own interests at all times. In other words, once you take care of the Taliban in Afghanistan, what happens to that country no longer matters to us.
Well, you know, I think that was the traditional debate. Was, you know, for example, in the 1990s, you know, there were many debates in the headlines about Bosnia and Somalia and countries like that. What did we need to be there for? Was it just because we couldn't stand seeing atrocities on CNN? Were we just, you know, too good-hearted to ignore it? The lesson of September 11th is that these places can hurt us in a way that we never imagined. The Bush administration's own national security strategy from September 2002 says quite plainly, quote, America's now more threatened by failing states than by conquering ones. And so the lesson of that is it's not just altruistic. When we're not paying attention, a place like Afghanistan, having, you know, spun off of the radar screen, and descended into civil war and horrors, could become a harbor for a group like Al-Qaeda. And I think that that really requires us to take a whole new look at these kinds of problems.
A lot of your book deals with how we're perceived around the world and how that may handicap us. Certainly during the build-up to going into Iraq, you saw this tremendous surge in anti-Americanism around the world. I don't know entirely what has happened to that, if it's still out there as strong, if what happened to in Iraq has made a difference. But for a lot of people, this is sort of a nebulous thing. It's hard for them to get a handle on what that means to this country, a country as strong as this, that there are a few populations around the world who really... And I don't just mean Arab populations, European populations, Asian populations, places where how we operate goes against everything they believe in.
Well, look, we're kidding ourselves if we think we can ignore this kind of hostility, that we're so powerful that we can just kind of shrug it off. Another lesson of 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11 is that we may be supremely powerful as a nation, you know, from the skies, raining death on the Taliban, taking out Saddam's regime in just a few weeks. It's clear the dominance there. But as individuals, we're just as vulnerable as anyone else, indeed more vulnerable, since we're Americans and people want to target us because we represent the number one power. And if we think, as a nation, that we can continue to essentially, you know, flout the norms of the international system and snub other countries, when, in fact, we need the most profound cooperation from other countries protect the open byways we ourselves have created, and we need cooperation from other intelligence agencies and other nations, for example, to indicate when there's some kind of an Al-Qaeda threat. We need the cooperation of other nations in terms of providing peacekeeping troops so that our GIs aren't the only ones dying. In so many respects, and on so many dimensions, we need this cooperation. I think that, you know, it's just a question of appreciating the implications of that.
There's a paragraph in your book that addresses what we're talking about here. You write, "Let's concede, if only for the sake of argument, that many of the typical criticisms of Americans we hear voiced around the world are on the mark. We have heard them so many times, there must be something to them. Americans are careless, Americans are arrogant, Americans are crude, American culture is appallingly superficial and materialistic, Americans are ignorant of history, Americans are hypocrites who betray their ideals of freedom and democracy. Guilty on all counts, and these complaints have always been present in America's relations with the world. Yet these commentaries still miss a more profound truth by a mile. For all our fumbling, the role played by the United States is the greatest gift the world has received in many, many centuries, possibly all of recorded history. what you seem to be asking in this book is that we take that role a little more seriously.
Well, that's right. I think that passage you read was, you know, mainly addressed to foreigners, those who are skeptical of American intentions and American power. For them, they need to step back themselves and understand that, you know, I think we are a uniquely benign power for all of our faults.
You say secretly they do say that. I mean, they don't.
Well, I think that is true. I think one of the tragedies, one of the unfortunate aspects of the Bush administration's lack of diplomacy is how gratuitous it is and how unnecessary it is. With a little bit of, Mr. Nice Guy behavior on the part of the president and some of the people around him with, you know, notoriously sharp tongues like Donald Rumsfeld, you could improve things enormously, because I think most other major nations are willing to accept an American-dominated international system as long as their faces are not rubbed in the brute actuality of American power. And that's, you know, that's kind of what we've been doing, what this administration has been doing. So I'm actually, you know, quite optimistic. I think the international system is a very powerful thing, and it's just a question of handling it the right way, diplomatically.
Michael Hirsch is my guest. The book is At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. And despite the title, it actually ultimately is an optimistic book, and it's a good one at this time to page through and get a handle on where this country is in the middle of 2003 when it comes to our place in the world and where we could be. We'll be back with Michael Hirsch after these messages. When a little ma-and-pa operation like the Highland Grill starts getting written up in restaurant magazines as offering something unique in the kitchen, it's hard to figure, because you drive by, it's not a terribly impressive place from the front. Heck, they don't even put the sign out front. You can hardly tell it's the Highland Grill. It just says hot food. Inside, nice atmosphere, nice ambiance, but still nothing on the menu over $10. Hard to figure this would be the kind of place they'd be writing about and that restaurant reviewers would be raving about, and yet that's what they've created at Ford Parkway in Cleveland and St. Paul. And if you stop on by, have a meal, and mention the program, there's a little gift in the basement. That's right, the basement. It's in a large box. They'll find it down there and dig it out and give it to you. Just my way of saying thanks for stopping by. Highland Grill supports this show. Please support this restaurant. Highland Grill, Ford in Cleveland in St. Paul. Program. Michael Hirsch is my guest, a senior editor at Newsweek's Washington Bureau. He's written a book titled At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. He argues in this book that our dominance makes it even more imperative that we stay connected in all ways to what's going on in this planet, and remember how diplomacy is the key to keeping those connections strong, even with institutions like the UN, which has taken quite a beating over the last few months, certainly by the conservative side here in this country. And what I'm curious about with your book, Michael, is where do you see, if we're squandering certain things, where do you see the next crisis unless something changes? If you're squandering something, somewhere along the line,
right,
something's going to hit the fan.
Well, that's right. We don't know. And the real question is, how much are we squandering? I think through inattention. I'm not just hammering away at the Bush administration, as you suggested earlier. I also criticized Clinton. But I think it's up to the American people to vote in presidents and senators and congressmen who understand that you can't just demonize the international system and its institutions every time something doesn't go right. We need to do a more systematic job of supporting these institutions. Where, you know, and when it comes to, you know, not cooperating with other countries, acting unilaterally, who knows what the cost might be. The cost could be some French or German or Russian intelligence agent who decides not to share a certain piece of information with the CIA about an incipient terror attack. It could be not getting the kind of cooperation we need from China, for example, to really make Kim Jong-il of North Korea stand down from plutonium reprocessing and getting to the point where, who knows, in a matter of months he might be able to sell a lump of plutonium across the border to some Al-Qaeda type group. It's impossible to say, but I think that there's a general intuitive sense, and I think it's right, that you do better with friends than without them. Once again, we're kidding ourselves if we can do without them.
You find yourself at the end of your book wishing that the Clinton administration's diplomatic skills combined with the Bush administration's ability to be direct and forceful and not be, I guess, wishy-washy when it comes to international relations. A combination of that would be ideal. With the Bush administration, there was some sense in this country that Colin Powell was going to be the guy who ensured that a Clinton administration-style diplomacy was still going to be there. Something changed there.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you had early on in the Bush administration, even before 9/11, was a sense that extreme conservatives were changing policy, were taking the United States in a somewhat different direction in terms of the way we treated the rest of the world. I know that there was a sense that after 80 years of Wilsonian globalism, as it's called, which is the idea that we're going to come to depend on international organizations, there was a real conservative reaction going on. And I think that's still going on to some extent, even in a post 9/11 period. So yes, there was a real shift in attitude and approach with the new administration.
I sometimes worry that historically, looking back, I see too many instances in this country where our best view is hindsight, and we're not a nation that has done a great job with foresight. I don't know quite why that is, whether that's an extraordinary gift that not a lot of people have, or whether in a nation where people are elected every few years, there's no gain in having foresight and looking further down the line. But sooner or later, we are punished in one way or another for our mistakes. Currently, what do you think the Bush administration is thinking about the war on Iraq? If we're at a point where they're maybe first at the beginning of seeing something they didn't plan on. Perhaps they expected the parades to last a little longer, the cheering. That's over. In fact,
it was over within 12 hours.
and it now is looking like a drawn-out affair, and we're reading that we don't know when troops will be coming home, and there's no sense anymore that we're in friendly territory. But how does that work on an administration in terms of a lesson, or how does this whole war work as a lesson?
Well, I think that clearly one thing it has done is blunted the eagerness of the so-called neoconservatives, I think the real hawks inside the Defense Department and the Vice President's office that were pushing for Iraq. I think it's blunted the move toward taking on regime after regime. You know, some of the early rhetoric against Syria right after the Iraq War has been toned down. You haven't really heard that. They've been rather muddling through on Iran. There's no clear policy there. Same thing with North Korea. You see a big slowdown, a new sobriety in this very aggressive foreign policy. That's one lesson. Another is that Bush, you know, may be in some political trouble going into 2004 if, as many people I talk to expect, the issue of WMD, weapons of mass destruction, and what was there and what wasn't, and whether the intelligence was skewed leading up to the war, those issues don't go away. And from what I understand, I don't think they are going to go away. And at the same time, Iraq continues to look rather quagmire-y, with GIs dying every week. I think, smart Democrats going to put two and two together and say, this shows a real vulnerability. Particularly if you raise the issue that, you know, we decided to go after Iraq at a time when perhaps the threat was not quite as imminent as as was being said, and we left Al-Qaeda in the field in Afghanistan and the tribal regions of Pakistan, which is an issue that has been paid less attention to now but may become more important.
Is it your sense, we've had the story in the last 48 hours buried in the newspapers here, actually, that Bush was admitting for the first time that, okay, he perhaps relied on faulty information going into this war, and that a lot of stuff he looked at was perhaps misleading. Did he, in your mind, care about that? Did that have anything to do with his decision to go into Iraq? And when I say that, I mean that sense that he was dealing with a dictator who was in a greater position of power than perhaps Hussein actually was.
Yeah.
Or was his sense, it doesn't matter, some say he was planning this before 9/11. I mean, what's your sense on that?
Well, I think that clearly if you look at people like Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Defense Secretary, who was one of the leading hawks on Iraq. I mean, he had been warning about Saddam since 1979. I mean, there had been long-term warnings, and there was a sense that to a certain extent, 9/11 was an excuse for the hawks to finally push their agenda and take out Saddam. But I don't believe that that it was entirely a preset agenda. I think that they genuinely believed right after 9/11 that the true nightmare would be if something like that happened with a weapon of mass destruction like a nuclear weapon. You know, you've got to remember, intelligence is always sketchy in the best of times. And after 1998, when the UN inspectors had been kicked out, we really didn't know exactly what Saddam had. So I am willing to cut the Bush administration a lot of slack and to take them at their word that they believed he was dangerous. I still think you can make the argument that that it was a precipitous act and we didn't need to do Iraq when we did.
I've not had this question answered before and have wanted to, especially have it answered by someone who may have a take on it that has some credibility. After 9/11, we had a moral high ground internationally here. We had the sympathy of the world, and after Afghanistan, we still had it, and you had a situation there where a statement was made that went out all over the world. The statement was, any country that we can find a connection to with any terrorist act against the United States, we will treat as though that country attacked us. Now, that's a forceful statement, and we followed through on it with the Afghani war. At that point, I thought the U.S. and this administration was really sitting in the catbird seat. We had followed up what we said with force, and now let's see who dares be caught supporting terrorism. When I think of using the term squandered, for me, something was squandered after that.
No, I could not agree more with your analysis. I think that's exactly what happens. Tragedy that at that point you describe, which was really through the Afghan war, taking on the Taliban, America had enormous consensus to do something really rough and tough when it came to Al-Qaeda. We had successfully by that point isolated the terrorists. We had isolated bin Laden. You may remember there were some fears that the Arab street, so-called, would rise when we attacked Afghanistan. It didn't happen. To go from that point where we had a kind of maximum of sympathy and support to the point where, rather than the terrorists, it was the United States that was isolated as we reached a decision on Iraq, I think we have to step back and ask ourselves some hard questions. How did that happen? And I think the administration, again, has to be blamed for that.
And that's why I have to almost give Bush the benefit of the doubt on this, that he really saw Iraq as a threat to this country, because why would you squander that position without honestly believing that this was yet another threat that had to be dealt with? Why would you take what was, I thought, an ideal situation and risk ruining it?
Well, I think there was a certain amount of hubris, quite frankly. The war in Afghanistan was so successful and so dramatic and was so unilateral. I mean, let's face it, it was entirely an American victory, that it kind of fed the already existing bias of this administration that, you know, that America could be unilateralist, that our power was such we could behave that way. And so I think there was a sense that they just didn't care, didn't care what the rest of the world thought. I think that's erroneous. I think that's wrong, and I hope they're now correcting that. I think we're seeing it day by day demonstrated how much we do need the rest of the world.
How confident are you that, if not democracy in Iraq, something that is close to it can be built there over time?
I think that with enough attention, as long as the American presence is maintained in some fashion, there's no reason to think that you can't have some form of democracy there. I think the neoconservatives are right about this. I mean, the essential critique that you hear from people like Paul Wolfowitz is, you know, why should the Arab world be the exception? Why did we have democratic transformations after the Cold War in East Asia and Latin America and the former Eastern Bloc, and why should it not be possible in the Arab world? But all that said, I still think it's going to be enormously difficult because there is not a tradition of democracy in this country. Not even the tradition that there was in, for example, Afghanistan of democracy. So it's a very, very tough task. It really is bottom-to-top nation building, and this is an administration that continues to say it doesn't do nation building. Of course we're doing nation building. That's precisely what we're doing there.
And I guess what also concerns me is how much the military does not want to play the role it's being asked to play right now in Iraq.
Well, this is an issue that leads to questions about why not use NATO, why not use the UN. I mean, this administration came into power talking about a quote-unquote division of labor in the world. America was going to be the uber power, the dominant power overseeing global stability. And others like the Europeans would help with peacekeeping tasks. And I think that's actually a pretty good idea. I think they had it right to begin with.
Right.
But you've got to do the diplomacy to ensure that others are interested in playing that kind of a role. And that's what they have not done. If you listen to Donald Rumsfeld's testimony before Congress yesterday, it was, you know, even there, it was, he was not clear on how much of a role NATO would play.
Michael Hirsch is the author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. I want to thank you, sir, for taking the time to be with me tonight and for your good effort on this book. It was a wonderful book to read, and I encourage others listening to pick it up. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It is time for Nancy Fox and the news.
Thank you, Tommy. It's mostly cloudy, 68 in the Twin Cities. Minneapolis investigators say they're not sure what the motive is behind the murder of a Minneapolis cab driver. A continuous horn blast led police to the man slumped over in his cab north of Oak Park Avenue on Penn Avenue. Many cabbies say driving to the 1100 block of Penn Avenue North is a ride they don't like, especially at night.
I don't drive at night. I stop driving at night.
Police say they're not sure if the shots were fired from inside or outside of the cab, but other drivers say that particular cab driver did have a bulletproof window in between the back and front seat. Cabbie's been identified as Ahmed Ahmed. Fellow cabbies say it was his first day back on the job from a week-long vacation. He was just married. This year's 4th of July holiday may have been the safest on Minnesota roads in the last 3 decades. So far, one traffic death has been reported for the holiday weekend that happened Friday night in Dodge County. A Ramsey County judge says Minnesota is free to keep collecting a 35-cent per pack fee on cigarettes made by smaller tobacco companies. Judge John Finley has denied a request for a restraining order to stop the fee, which went into place at the beginning of the month. It is the talk of baseball and beyond. A misdemeanor disorderly conduct count against Pittsburgh Pirates first baseman Randall Simon for swatting the sausage with a baseball bat during a mascot race at the Milwaukee Brewers Stadium. In Milwaukee today, Sheriff David Clark met with reporters.
I think everybody can appreciate a good time and a few yucks. I mean, I like to laugh as much as anybody, believe it or not. And we all want people to have fun at the ballpark. But sometimes fun crosses the line.
Officials decided this afternoon that no assault charges would be filed. Dave Dahl, SkyMax 5 forecast. Partly cloudy tonight with sprinkles possible. 60 tomorrow, isolated rain and a high of 75.
Thank you. political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times where men commit crimes, and crime don't have a face. We live in a political world. Alcatraz hanging down. Wedding bells ringing, angels singing, clouds cover up the ground. We live in a political world. Wisdom is thrown into jail. It rots in a cell misguided as hell, leaving no one to pick up the trail.
Mishki Broadcast, Black Sheep Broadcasting Network. News flash. Pluto's atmosphere expands. Forget your neighborhood issues, your citywide issues, your state issues, your national issues, your international issues. I'm taking the issues up into space here. That's ultimately where we need to direct our attention, if you ask me. Now, what does this mean, Pluto's atmosphere is expanding? Well, it goes as follows. Winter's impending chill was supposed to put a damper on Pluto. So it was quite a surprise to astronomers when they got a glimpse of the oddball planet as it moved away from the sun and saw that its atmosphere was expanding. By the way, that's the Associated Press calling it the oddball planet. That's not me. I have never referred to Pluto as the oddball planet. I don't know why it's referred to as the oddball planet. Wonder if Pluto knows it's being referred to in this manner. You don't hear Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Mercury being referred to as odd, huh? Are they really any less odd as celestial bodies? Who's to say what's normal out there? I think the whole universe is odd, if you ask me. Peculiar, strange, fickle, waggish Pluto, huh? Flaky, idiosyncratic, eccentric, offbeat, curious and erratic. Quirky, flaky, idiosyncratic, eccentric, offbeat, weird and erratic. It's what the people say wherever you go, and you know they're talking about Pluto. Poor Pluto. I honestly don't know how it got this label. Many observers figured Pluto's atmosphere, made mostly of nitrogen, would contract as the planet moved away from the sun and towards its winter. Instead, the planet's temperature increased and its atmosphere became slightly larger. This is very strange. Now, these observations are timely. Pluto's orbit over the next few years offers an opportunity to learn more about this planet at a time when technological developments make it feasible to consider a mission to Pluto. This, according to William Hubbard of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona. Again, it is feasible now to consider a mission to Pluto. A mission to Pluto? Now that's odd. A mission to Pluto? Mission freaking impossible? You ask me, huh?
Impossible, illogical, and also inconceivable Pluto. Out of reach, unobtainable, beyond our power, unbridgeable Pluto. Pluto.
You never knew the lyrics to this song, did you? Oh, yeah. Impossible. Inconceivable. How the hell are we going to get to Pluto? Huh? We're not on Mars yet. We're not going to Pluto. I'm not going to stand by and allow that money to be spent. Pluto? What are you talking about? Oh, here's more on it being an odd planet. Earthly fans of Pluto, known as Plutophiles, are extremely loyal to this weird little planet, and have often noted that it is the only planet in our solar system never visited by spacecraft. What? We've been to the rest? You're out of your mind. Where the hell was I? Maybe they just mean little probes, although we've probed all the other planets. Smaller than Earth's moon, its orbit is highly eccentric, out of line with the other planets, and varying in its distance from the sun by 2,000 million miles over the course of a year. In fact, there has been debate over whether Pluto is really a planet at all. Some astronomers contend it's not a planet. It's a Kuiper belt object, a collection of cosmic ice balls in a zone beyond Neptune. That's what some people say. Some people just stand up and say, that's no planet. What you got there is some belt object. That's a collection of cosmic ice balls in a zone just beyond Neptune there. Of course, those folks were hitting the sauce pretty good when they said that. They were hitting the sauce pretty good. Personally, I think Pluto is sort of a cosmic foosball, golf ball, ping pong ball type thing set aside for God's use during his leisure hours, which haven't come along, really, in our lifetime on account of an unusually busy stretch of cosmic activity. But scientists say not golf ball or foosball, oddball. It's the oddball planet. Oddball? How does one play that game? Oddball. Ever play a game of oddball? It's different. Nine men on a team, playing a team made up of seven men in a game timed by the weather, where athletes run, but not on fields. No, they run bait shops. Oddball. You ever play it? Every game's a tie unless it snows. Oddball. Coming to a stadium lavatory mirror near you. Spectators are encouraged to stay home. It's oddball, a game for the 21st century. Everyone's going to be playing it. Everyone's going to be playing it. Oddball. We've been to all the other planets. Mishki Broadcast, Black Sheep Broadcasting Network. Coming up on the top of the hour, we'll be back after ABC News with more of what you come here for. Write that down. In the meantime, I'm going to step over here and...
From ABC News, I'm Paul James. Claudia and Bill Walkenback of Herman, Missouri have some dollars they won in the Powerball multi-state lottery. She wants to replace her 30-year-old refrigerator. As for her husband...
I have a 1950 Ferguson tractor with no brakes. I think I'm going to buy a tractor with...
Yeah, there you go. You're going to get a tractor. That's the only two things we've talked about.
The second winning ticket was sold in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania, about 20 miles north of Pittsburgh. So far, no one there has come forward.
Just stop it.
But tell them Rook sent you. From the bleak, barren, inner-city tarmac of University Avenue, we return to your radio road hazard. The Mishki Broadcast, transmitting live from the last 90 feet of St. Paul, courtesy of the Black Sheep Broadcasting Network.
Thank you, Kodiak. What a bizarre story this is. Clownfish can change their sex. Clownfish? Am I supposed to know what clownfish are? Oh, those were the fish featured in the Disney film Finding Nemo. Clownfish! And now they're learning they can change their sex. Scientists could have written an R-rated gender-bending plot twist to Disney's Finding Nemo. Clownfish have a natural ability to change their sex. Clownfish, the aquarium pet of choice these days since the release of the animated movie Finding Nemo, live in a very rigid social structure. So rigid that if one of the dominant breeding adults is removed, the size, status, and even sex of the other clownfish change, and change rapidly, to return the group to the status quo. For instance, if the female of the group dies, the male just changes sex and becomes the breeding female. Doesn't particularly like the job, but he accepts it. You picture something like this happening in the human world, and the imagination runs wild. Take a Hugh Hefner, for instance. Word comes down he has to change his sex. Hef has to go female for the duration of his existence to maintain the status quo. First day on the job, he's picked to be a centerfold. He says, okay, seems like an easy enough gig. Until he realizes he also has to be one of seven girlfriends of the new Playboy CEO, who happens to be Merv Griffin. Hef sleeping with Merv is a wake-up call to the guy's 17-year-old mind. And he thinks maybe there is more to life than sex. Maybe there is more, after all. There better be for Hef's sake, because he's got a long row to hoe. Merv's calling from the other room, third time today. He's humming the tune to Viva Viagra. Hef isn't happy. Hef is not happy.
I'm not happy.
No, he's not. Into the room you go there. Clown man. Singapore is lifting a ban on chewing gum. Thought I'd pass that along to you folks. Any of you out there heading to Singapore for a vacation, feel free to pack a pack. Pack a pack. Singapore lifts ban on chewing gum. Huh? Is it still illegal to leave the spearmint on the bedpost overnight? The government of Singapore announced today it will allow chewing gum, long banned in the country, to be sold, though only in pharmacies. The decision stems from a recently signed free trade agreement between the U.S. and Singapore and follows lobbying from the U.S. Congress and American gum makers. You know, we rarely hear from American gum makers. Singapore heard from them loud and clear. Squeaky clean Singapore outlawed gum, the manufacture and sale, back in 1992. They complained that spent wads were fouling up the state's tidy pavements and buildings and buses and subway trains. But Philip Crane, who is chairman of the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee, and happens to be a congressman from Illinois, where the big gum giant Wrigley is headquartered, he pressed Singapore to loosen the ban, and he pressed hard. Singapore responded by having the congressman caned. Actually, Singapore initially agreed to allow gum to be sold, but only with a doctor's prescription. That's legitimate. I'm not adding that. I'm not embellishing. They actually were going to say, okay, you can have gum with a doctor's prescription. That, of course, didn't satisfy U.S. negotiators, since very few doctors offer gum prescriptions. If you get lockjaw, they may, but that's a rarity now with the tetanus shots and that sort of thing. This is fascinating to me. I don't chew gum myself. I don't know if I've told you people that. I don't chew gum. Used to, but then the realization hit me that it doesn't offer the satisfying conclusion the chewing of food does. That being the swallowing. It's just chewing and chewing and chewing without clear purpose. And then after a spell, one realizes this thing in the mouth is offering nothing and the gum is spit out. And you feel stupid. It's absurd when you think about it. Chewing is supposed to be the process of breaking down larger things into smaller things so that they can fit comfortably down the esophagus. When you chew gum, you're turning this whole concept on its ear. And in essence, you're giving nature the finger. That's what I concluded. You're giving nature the finger. And I wasn't going to be a party to that. No, sirree, Robert. So I quit chewing gum. Quit cold turkey one afternoon. Plus, I think I called in a bomb threat to the Wrigley Company. And that got me labeled an anti-gum fanatic. And I damn near got deported. Guess where to, huh? Singapore. Where the only jobs available are sidewalk crack filler and inner city bus exhaust pipe polisher. So I admitted my guilt, did time in an asylum, and checked out of a halfway house about 6 months ago, moved into my own apartment now. I'm studying cows and the chewing of cud at present. I'm with the Cud Research Facility out of Fridley. You familiar with it? I moonlight as a radio talk show host. Man's got to pay his bills, you know. Anywho, let's go to the horn here. Billy!
Hey, Mishki.
Hi.
What's up?
You tell me.
Well, you're talking about the Singapore thing? Why'd they have a ban on gum in the first place?
Well, because wads were showing up on their pavement in the subway areas and buildings under desks, and they said, nuts to that noise. It was just too messy. I don't know if you know much about Singapore, but they pride themselves on everything being perfect. You can get caned for a little bit of graffiti, as we found out with the American Michael Faye. Don't you recall the Michael Faye story?
Oh, yes. Oh, I recall the dilemma.
They spanked our boy.
Yeah, they did. Maybe. Gum's bizarre. Yeah, bottom of your shoes. I can see how it could get banned, but it's big here. Huge.
It is?
I think so. I mean, you go and you're standing there at the gas station, you see all that different varieties. That's some business there.
But do you ever see anyone actually buying the gum? I see it for sale, but I've never seen anyone actually purchase it.
I've purchased the gum.
What's your brand?
Big Wrigley is just 25-cent pack because on the rare occasion I buy it, just go for the cheap quarter pack.
And what do you get out of it?
Usually a couple sticks and then it gets lost. And you find it, like, in between your car seat, like, you're trying to...
You know what it's supposed to be good for, according to Richard Gere in the movie American Gigolo? It's supposed to be good for getting rid of the fat under your chin.
I bet it could do that. I mean, I'm sure there's addicted gum chewers out there. There's probably a little 12-step program people could go through.
Wonder if anyone else in radio tonight is referencing American Gigolo.
Probably not.
Did you see the film?
Yeah, Richard Gere film. Mm-hmm. Short guy.
Short guy? Is he short?
He is short. They always make him look taller.
They're all short. All of them.
He's
Al Pacino.
Tom Cruise. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all dwarves. All right, thanks so much, Billy.
Good talking to you, Mr.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, I think we have to go away, but we'll be back. I'm almost positive. 100% sure, actually. Chance of an aneurysm? Slim and none.
I drink that summit beer.
Wunderbar!
Yes, wunderbar. Ladies and gentlemen, they follow the German purity laws of the 1500s. Oh, you can put your barley hops and your water and little yeast in there, but don't you go throwing any other junk in there and call it beer. In Germany, you can't, I'll tell you what. You know, Budweiser throws rice in their beer. I don't know. I don't think I'm in Asia. I don't drink that swill. And as for Miller, the other big shooter, well, you get all those artificial enzymes and preservatives in the beer, and you can't call that beer either, not in Germany. So you take the two best-selling beers in America, you bring them to Germany, and the Germans, who are the masters, say, can't even call it beer. Sorry. Summit you can call beer. So I'm going to call it beer, and I'm going to ask you to try the beer. Summit Brewing Company, St. Paul, Minnesota.
O'Connell and Woodley.
Now you're talking, Michigan.
Black Sheep Broadcasting Network, coming to you live off the bleak, barren tarmac, University Avenue, St. Paul, Minnesota. Patrick's got an offer for you. Patrick, welcome.
Thank you.
You have an offer for the kind listeners of the old broadcast, the folks who are good enough to tune in night after night when the rest of the world is watching television.
Yes.
What you got for them?
All right. My father told me that money doesn't grow on trees.
I hope you cold cocked him.
Well, no, I always believed him.
No.
And there's also no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, you haven't gone to lunch with me.
And then, well, that's the end of that. But, yes, I do have an offer. A lot of the old listeners probably know who I am and have already, stopped by, but I will offer to all the listeners free bowling and shoe rental. There's only one stipulation. You've got to contact me and schedule it, or at least let me know you're coming. That's the only stipulation.
Ladies and gentlemen, Patrick, of course, do you manage the bowling alley? Or are you just a working stiff there?
No, I'm going to be there for a real long time.
You're taking over, aren't you?
No.
You know,
no,
I'll tell you something.
I'm not blood.
Oh, I see.
All right.
It's a family joint. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dracula's in Inver Grove Heights. If you want to bowl, and I like to think of bowling as the national pastime. I know I said earlier that oddball is the national pastime, but it's not oddball, it's not foosball, it's not ping pong, it's bowling. And the reason it's bowling is because everybody can do it. Everybody can bowl. I saw a legless dwarf bowling recently. Here's the deal. Patrick is offering you guys free bowling. You can just show up and bowl as long as you get a hold of him first. Now, he's at the joint most of the time, I assume.
Days,
yeah.
Yeah, days.
I mean, this is a swell offer. There's no strings, nothing. You just have to make sure you get a hold of him and then go have some fun for nothing.
Yep.
When I was a boy, and Shep was a pup.
Over the hills we would roam.
When I was a boy, they had a deal down at Lucky Lanes in Highland on Ford Parkway, where if you were 12 and under, from April 1 to end of August or something, which was downtime at the bowling alley, you could bowl for free.
The same sort of deal when I was a kid MTC had, where you could ride the bus for free anywhere you wanted.
Yes, and but you have to talk.
I realize they got to get a hold of you first.
Yes, they got to tell me they're coming.
Yeah, they got to tell you they're coming, but still, the joy of free things. I rode buses all over the place. I bowled like crazy just because it was free.
Well,
now,
I told the family had 8 listeners.
You may be surprised, my friend, at what you find at Dracula's. Did it used to be called Dracula's, and they didn't like that, so they changed the emphasis?
No.
Oh. What's the logo for the place?
They don't have one. It's a family.
Oh. I heard it was a beautiful gal out on a slab.
No, they don't.
Bleeding like a stuck pig.
Nope. Nope.
Okay,
nope,
well...
No, but it is an absolutely serious offer.
All
so
right.
You, people out there that...
All right.
Think that it's a joke. It's not.
Not a joke.
Nope.
Nothing funny about that.
Nope.
Well, Patrick, that's a hell of an offer, and I want to take this opportunity to thank you for thinking of us.
All right.
Thinking of us. Thank you, sir. And let me know how it goes, will you?
Yes.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Patrick. And he manages Dracula. I can't stop this feeling. That bastard's biting me. Man, you just don't realize what you do to me. When you hold me in your arms so tight and you bite down, feels out of sight. I need me a wooden stick. Who do we have?
Now calling in. Undertaker Fred.
Hey, Freddy boy.
Hey,
Freddy boy, you know what Patrick told the people at Dracula's? He said I had 8 listeners, and the odds of more than a fourth of them showing up were slim and none.
That's crazy, but there are people all over the... No, well, you might have a big eye-opener there.
Oh.
And I was thinking, you know, I'm making an offer now. Anybody that wants to see or hear me, they can come out to Orono Public Golf tomorrow morning from 9 to 2.
What would they do, Fred? Go out and... I guess this is the first time that we're doing this. Meet Undertaker Fred.
Yes.
Hi, folks.
Yes.
Here's a promotion on the old broadcast. Stop out at the Orono Golf Course tomorrow and meet Fred.
Yeah, I'll be there from 9 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon, and I haven't been there for about 2 weeks now, so...
My listeners are coming up with their own little promotion.
Well, it'll be a great thing. It's a real fun place to play golf, too. I seriously have Patrick Royce. I think he's gone now, maybe on a trip or something, but he threatened to come out there and see me.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I know I can't get you to go that far, but I was talking...
Oh, it's not the distance, my friend. It's the sport.
No. I know it. It's a sport. Yeah, I know that.
If we can call it that.
Yeah, if we can call it that, right? But I was thinking about, you were talking about gum a little while there, and I thought about over in 60 years ago when I was in Italy. You know what the little kids ask for all the time?
A casket?
No. That was before I was in that. I've been in that too, but no, they said chew gum, Joe. Chew gum, Joe.
Either chew gum Joe?
We were either chew gum Joe or chocolata.
Did they ever come up to you and say, American, A number one?
Oh, yeah. They were very complimentary. It's like in other foreign countries today that many of them.
Did they ever come up to you and say, Betty Grable, nice gams?
Oh, yes. That's true, too. But I was thinking, you know, 2 nights ago you had Patrick, the other Patrick, who was going from here to the Big Apple.
Yes, he was. He was moving back to New York City and was no longer going to be able to listen to the show.
I know, and he used to work at the university. He lost his job at the university, and he was going into some kind of classical music writing or something.
Yes, he was, and he was sitting at the terminal out at the airport, and he wanted me to stop out there after the show and have a drink with him. And I felt kind of bad after the show, knowing I had let him down, but...
Well,
I just didn't want to drive that far. I live in a little tiny world, Fred.
You,
little world.
You and me. I'm in a small world too.
Yeah.
And I, but we are the oddball planet. You were saying Pluto was the oddball planet.
There you go, Freddy boy. Why didn't I think of that? We're the oddball planet.
We're the oddball planet.
There's nothing bizarre happening on those other ones. We're the ones who are doing strange things.
Yeah, we're doing strange things.
Can you imagine for a moment? Just imagine this: aliens arrive. They pick some, because they always are picking remote areas. Chances of them running into a lot of people, slim. They'd probably run into one or two people, because they're always picking these rural areas late at night, that sort of thing. So aliens arrive.
Yeah.
Say the first people they encounter, and we've heard a lot of this in the news lately, are Siamese twins, or conjoined twins, whatever you want to call them.
Yes.
And that's the very first view they have of humanity, these Siamese twins come out to greet them.
Yeah.
Maybe the surgery's in a couple of days, they're still joined, and they walk out.
Yeah.
And the aliens, maybe they bolt right then and there, and they go back and report back on what we are. And they label us the oddball planet. But that was just one or two people they saw. Well, I guess two people. That depends on your view, actually.
Well, that would be like my grandson, who used to, when he was little, they'd go to the mall at Ridgedale, for example. And he'd always say, "How do you get out of here? How do you get out of here?"
Man after my own heart.
Yeah.
Or the first person that they meet is that Elephant Man fella. What was his name? John? What was his last name? I used to know that.
Yeah. I can't remember the name, but I saw him.
John
Tesh. Yeah.
No, he writes elephant music.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. I wanted to mention then that last night you had this...
I'm not an animal. What? I'm a song.
But last night you had this fellow in that was quite despondent, and he was... you were going to attempt to take him to AA today. Were you able to do that?
Yeah.
You were?
Yeah.
Good. Well, that's good. I give you a big star on your crown for that, Tommy.
Oh, don't, because it didn't take.
It didn't take.
No.
Well, if he happens to be listening tonight, I'll give him something that will take.
Oh, Fred, you're sounding awfully confident.
I am confident. Did you hear the one thing he said last night, that he knows everything? Did you hear him say that?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why it didn't take, because he's too cocky, too full of himself, too smart for his own good, and without some humility, he's not going to be able to take this step. But it was a worthwhile effort, but he really ultimately didn't want to be helped. In fact, he was told during the AA meeting to shut up by the guy running it, which is a bad sign.
Well, that's a bad sign, but... If he happens to be listening tonight, I know he came on with a big spiel of some words that nobody, not any normal person could understand,
mm-hmm.
right after that when he said he knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the guy in the ministerial group, they were talking once about a cacophony of hermeneutical mendacity. That means that everybody talking at once, on something that is of a spiritual nature, and nobody knows anything about it. And cacophony of hermeneutical mendacity. If he happens to be listening, I'm being serious here now, to try to help him to realize there's only one person who knows, only one that knows everything, and that's God. And God can even prevent or forget things himself if he wants to. Otherwise, he can't do anything he wants to do. So, I mean...
Well, Fred, the fella said he'd like to meet you sometime, so maybe he should go to Orono Golf Course tomorrow.
Well, if he comes out there, we'll sit down and watch The Price is Right. And
now, that'll sober anybody.
And I always watch the governor's, the former governor's favorite program out there, The Young Are the Restless.
Okay, Fred, I got to go.
But, Tommy, we got to sing...
can't.
In the good old summertime.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime. Walking down
we
the
we be having you with my baby fine, the old grand, and you're older, and that's a very good sign. You're tootsie wootsie in the good old summertime. God
bless. It's the bottom of the hour, and it's time for Nancy Wildcat Fox in the news.
66 and cloudy in the Twin Cities. They're cleaning up from tornado damage today in Panic, about 100 miles west of the Twin Cities. Damage there was heavy in a few places, but rather spotty. Residents said it got pretty wild at one point.
We had rain, light rain, and all of a sudden it turned real heavy rain, and then all of a sudden the wind came up just very dramatic.
Well, it was really loud. We went down the basement, and your ears would pop. So it was like the air was totally sucked out of the house.
A large barn containing several thousand turkeys was destroyed, killing several hundred birds in the process. Twisters were also reported in Danvers and Lake Crystal. No injuries have been reported from any of those storms. The Minnesota pastor imprisoned in Laos for more than a month has been reunited with his family in Minnesota today. The family of Na Carl Moa met him at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport when he arrived this afternoon. The Moa family says he returned sooner than expected thanks to the assistance of Minnesota Senator Mark Dayton. State safety officials have reported a 16% increase in state traffic deaths.
Can I just say that Minnesota has now officially heard from Mark Dayton? Since the election, we've been waiting, and I just want to say it's nice to hear of Mark Dayton doing something. Very good. Haven't heard much from Mark Dayton.
Well, we have now.
Yeah, he's done something. You know, he's emerged from his cocoon. He needs a PR team.
For a while, he was doing this Put Mark to Work for You campaign, where he would come back on the weekend during the congressional recess, and he'd wash dishes at the VA. And
well, he didn't,
you know,
tell anybody.
He'd bust tables at the bus depot.
He forgot to tell somebody he was doing that. I'm not kidding. What has that man done? I'm sure he's working, but he has what has to be the worst PR team in Minnesota.
Maybe he doesn't have a PR team. Perhaps that's the problem.
You say his name and people think 50% off on slacks.
And those are the old people who remember when it was still Dayton's.
Oh, isn't it anymore? What the hell is it? Broadcasting Network. The EU is getting its own anthem. A future European Union constitution will include a flag, an anthem, a motto. Yipty-dipty-dipty-dipty-doo. The 105-member convention, the Economic Union, the European Union, the European Economic Union, the EU. The 105-member EU convention decided at its final session today to add reference to the symbols of the 15-nation bloc, due to be enlarged to 25 states next May. The official EU flag is the dark blue banner with 12 yellow stars in a circle. The motto is United in Diversity, which is not dissimilar from the first motto of the U.S., E Pluribus Unum. Europe Day is going to be May 9th, commemorating a historic speech by French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman. Doesn't sound like the name of a frog, does it? Bob Schuman. But he was one of the EU's founding fathers. Yeah. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington,
Bob Schumann. And they're going to have an official song. They're going to have an anthem, their own anthem. Hey, you rascals, stand up and dance. Look who's buddies, Germany and France. Oh, Spain and Britain, they now get along. Everybody on your feet, ain't this union neat? Come on, let's sing this song. Yeah! Italy is not under fire. Now that there's no Roman Empire, even Greece and Belgium, they have a say. Not as much as others, they're like annoying little brothers, they sometimes get in the way. But Czechoslovakia, they're in it too. Luxembourg will be used as a loo. So if you have to go number one or number two, consider it your toilet bowl. Yes, they have a special role. What else are they good for? Come on, Europe, let's all get blotto. We have a song, a flag, and a motto. Oh, let's jump on our motorbike, get in our auto. Don't be lazy, drive like you're crazy. Wait, we do that already. If we add more nations, we'll carry more weight. We'll be able to compete with the United States. So if one day we end up going to war, we won't run like a scared bunny. We'll give them a run for their money, possibly take D.C. America thinks that they're number one. Their empire never sees the setting sun, but every empire eventually dies. What goes up must come down. Yankee, do you hear that sound? The bells toll for your demise. A fall follows every rise. It's you that we all despise, you arrogant, conceited guys. What lives now one day dies. Dobro man.
Hey Tommy, how you doing?
Better turn down that radio. I hear somebody laughing in the background.
Yeah, that was, I gotta shut it down. Hey, who was that guy that you just had on with the introduction on that Dobro music?
That was John Mellencamp, and he was playing a song written by Woody Guthrie in a tribute album.
I like that Dobro that was in there.
Yeah, well, it's from a CD entitled A Vision Shared, tribute to Lead Belly and Woody.
Yeah. Hey, I heard Undertaker Fred, you had a guy that you brought to AA last night?
I brought him today, yeah.
Didn't work out, huh?
No, it was a disaster. He didn't really want help, ultimately. The hope was that he was sincere, but he really wasn't.
Yeah, well, in his time, he'll, like you said, you got to have humility, and
yeah.
In his time.
Yeah.
That's, well, I was just listening tonight. I just picked up my daughter from the movie, so I just thought, well, I got to call in. I haven't talked to you for a while, so.
How often in your AA meetings do you get a newcomer?
Probably maybe, you know, once every couple months you'll get somebody new in, or 3 months.
And when they come in, how many are really ready and how many are just stopping by to check it out?
Nah, we probably get maybe one out of five. Usually when they come in there, they're hurting pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're ready to take a look at themselves.
Yeah. But when you say one out of five, I'm assuming still a lot of them, it must not work out.
No, they come in and then, you know, there's always excuses. They don't want to look at themselves, so then they don't come back. But I've been in there long enough so that there's guys that will come in, they'll leave, they'll come back, and it takes 2-3 times, and finally they get real and,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, Dobro man, you're breaking up a little bit, so I'm going to let you go.
You know what I say?
What?
Summit Brewing.
What I say. You know what I say to alcoholics everywhere. One beer isn't going to kill you.
Right. Hey, check it out.
See ya.
See ya. That's what he was setting me up for.
One beer's too many and 100's not enough. This is an unfortunate turn of events. Headline from today's news: demolition crew tears down wrong house.
Whoops and daisy.
Oh, Jenny Lopez's home is a pile of rubble tonight after a demolition crew mistakenly tore down the wrong house. They were supposed to tear down the one across the street.
Whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy.
What a gap.
Whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy.
A big blunder.
Whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy.
A major flub.
Whoops a daisy.
Stupidity.
Whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy, whoops a daisy.
That's Mikey Lunan and the Ben House Boys. The house that was supposed to be demolished today was across the street from Jenny's house. House numbers in this particular Phoenix neighborhood are not well marked. All the mailboxes sit on one side of the street, making identification difficult. Anyway, this investment group hired contractors to tear down the house across the street from Jenny Lopez's. It was vacant. It was boarded up. It was fenced in. But that house was left standing. Lopez wasn't home at the time. One of her neighbors spotted the heavy construction equipment in her yard and alerted her at work. But by the time she came home, the house was already rubble. Demolition man David Gomez declined a comment about the incident, but told a television station that he would probably be losing his job soon. Well, it could be worse, Dave. You could have lost your house. You know, in Singapore, that eye for an eye rule calls for you to lose your house in this sort of a situation. You're just going to lose your job, Dave. Jobs are a dime a dozen. A house you've lived in for years with all your valuables inside, your heirlooms, your memories, that's a tougher thing to replace. Yeah. When you were tearing it down, you didn't happen to ask yourself why someone had left inside all the furniture and the china and the antiques, did you, Dave? Because that's unusual to leave all that inside. And when you saw Grandma sleeping in the bed there in the den, you must have said, this isn't like other demolition projects. How do you make the lath and the rafters drop either side of the old gal just so? How do you... Boy, I'm going to have to finesse this one. Whoops, that chunk of plaster had to hurt. Be a little careful there, fellas. Whoa! Who's that? Another lady? What the hell's going on here? Oh, my God, what a mess. Dave, this must have been about the time your fleeting employment passed before your eyes. It's amazing he still had his job by the time the TV people got to him. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the show tonight dedicated to
the King Columbia River and the Great Grand Coulee Dam.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow night with a visit from John Hite. That old newsman is going to make a rare appearance working the night shift. And I'm going to mess with him, but good. I'm going to teach him the meaning of the word respect. And I'm going to torture him like no newsman has been tortured in the history of broadcasting. That's tomorrow night on the Mischke Broadcast. You're listening to KSTP here in good old St. Paul, the big time Minneapolis. You sleep well now.